He stared at the bar stool between us.
I see.
You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?
What did this young woman look like, if you don't mind me asking?
Long black hair, mid-twenties, dressed in a pink top with a black skirt. It appeared that he was thinking about it and seemed sad that I was asking.
No, Sheriff, I'm afraid not.
I watched what looked like a flood of emotions in him, a mixture of sorrow, loss, and then suspicion.
What has happened to this young woman?
I'm afraid it's an ongoing investigation, and I'm not in a position to divulge that sort of information at this time. I listened as the training kicked in and thought about how I sounded like a recording and that maybe after the statement I should have beeped. I had had this feeling before. Are you going to be in the area long, Mr. Tuyan? He seemed preoccupied, but answered with the same practiced smile.
Yes, the property I am looking at is near the town of Bailey, which is nearby.
Just up the way, off County Road 192. What's the name of the property?
Excuse me?
I leaned on the bar and tried to get a read on him. The property you're thinking of buying, Mr. Tuyan. He pulled what looked to be a fax from one of the realty offices in Durant. I studied it. The Red Fork Ranch. That's a nice place. I handed the paper back to him and noted it was dated yesterday. Richard Whitehead moving?
I'm afraid I do not know. I only know that the property is for sale.
He returned the paper to his pocket, his license to his wallet, slipped a 10 from it, and then stood and placed the billfold into his jacket. He was about 5'9", tall for a Vietnamese, thick of wrist, and his movements were very precise. Mind if I ask where you're staying?
The hole-in-the-wall motel in room number 3.
He picked up the empty bottle and set it on the inside of the bar.
I'm going to look at the property after I leave here. You're not going to pull me over a mile up the road, are you?
He sighed.
Because if you are, I'll just take the breathalyzer test now.
I inclined my head toward him. I get the feeling I've offended you, Mr. Tuyan. He didn't say anything. If I have, I certainly didn't mean to. I'm sorry to say that we don't get too many Vietnamese here in Wyoming, and you'll have to excuse me if I find it odd that we should suddenly have 2. I continued to look at the man and was conflicted with my own mix of feelings. It was possible that I was bordering on racial profiling. He smiled, just enough so that you weren't sure if he'd done it at all. He took a card from his breast pocket and handed it to me. His head dropped, and he headed for the door. He looked back when I followed him and paused for a moment with his head still down. The smile was gone. He pushed the door open and disappeared. Santiago stood and laid a 5 on the bar. If you think of anything, here's my card. Give me a call. Philip Maynard palmed the fin and the card. He called after us, but mostly to Katie. Come on back, any time. The glass door bumped unevenly behind us. Tran Van Tuyen was driving west in the Land Rover, which looked like a passing emerald in a backdrop of overexposed sepia as it rolled down the main street of Powder Junction. It was an absolutely gorgeous summer afternoon, and I took a deep breath, like I always did when I remembered it was the payoff time of the year, and felt like crap. Katie pulled my arm, always reading the fine print of emotion when I was attempting to appear unruffled. She hugged me.
What's the matter?
What's Wi-Fi?
Daddy!
I took a deep breath and hitched the thumb in my gun belt. I'm afraid I may have just engaged in a bit of profiling. I watched as Tuyen faced straight ahead, and the shiny green utility vehicle made the turn on 192 and then under the overpass of I-25. I squeezed her arm back. You were popular in there. I plucked a pen from my deputy and scribbled Tuyen's license plate number on the envelope of the dead Vietnamese woman's personal property packet. I read his card. Trung Sisters Distributing, with an address in Culver City and 3 phone numbers.
I glanced at the Cheyenne Nation as they handed Sizar Vittoria back his pen. What do you think? Henry took a breath.
Yes, Walter, you are deeply prejudiced, and I have long been meaning to discuss this with you.
I nodded and dug into the property envelope as they all watched me. Only against Injuns.
He nodded. It is to be expected.
I plucked out the plastic bag I wanted and handed the larger one back to Sancho, who was smiling and shaking his head at our banter.
You didn't ask him about the Indians and the matches, boss?
No, I didn't.
Call those two numbers in to Ruby and see what she comes up with. Then check the hole in the wall to see if he's registered and alert the HPs just in case he decides to go somewhere.
Got it. He disappeared into his unit and left us standing on Powder Junction's old west boardwalk. The Cheyenne Nation and my daughter watched as I searched the Ziploc. She tugged at the short hair near the scar.
What are you doing, Daddy?
I didn't answer her, but held up the key fob, still in the plastic, and pushed the button. The lights flashed and the doors unlocked on the maroon Buick Junker at the end of the row. Chapter 5. The car had been stolen from a not-so-small community in Southern California called Westminster, which was, according to the dispatcher at the Orange County Sheriff's Department, better known as Little Saigon. Ruby said she'd spoken with a charming young man who'd confirmed the not-so-grand theft auto. He said that the vehicle had been stolen from a recycler's lot and that the former owner, Lee Nguyen, had stated that he'd donated the Buick to charity, but that the organization must have decided the car wasn't worth the trouble. We'd done as much physical investigation of the automobile as our limited abilities would allow, so we loaded the rusty sedan onto a flatbed and shipped it off to Cheyenne. The fingerprints we'd lifted from the vehicle were probably female, judging from their size, or possibly from a child, and the tread deposits were from the immediate vicinity. There was nothing in the trunk, and the only thing in the glove compartment was a receipt for a new water pump that had been replaced in Nephi, Utah, only 3 days earlier. I sent Henry and Katie back to Durant in my truck, since Katie was looking a little tired, and hitched a ride with Sizar Vittoria over to the sheriff's substation. We drove with the windows down, since the Suburban didn't have air conditioning. Santiago spoke over the heated wind and the monster motor that got about 8 miles to the gallon. The bartender didn't seem genuinely surprised about the Buick. We'd gone back in and questioned the guy again. He said he'd noticed the car there, but that he didn't think it was a big deal. He said that even in the short time he'd been here, he'd noticed a lot of people got ripped and left their cars and trucks on the street rather than be harassed by us. I had asked him if a lot of them came from California, to which he'd responded that he hadn't noticed the license plates. Did he seem more nervous the first time we questioned him? The Basco thought about it.
Yes, he did.
Why do you suppose that is?
The guy in the corner? Two yen?
I think so, too.
We parked in front of the Wyoming Department of Transportation annex, where we had a small office. I'll call Ruby and see if she's got anything on this two-yen guy or heard anything from DCI. You check on the repair bill in Nephi. I handed him the plastic bag which had the receipt in it. He looked at me, a little worried.
I think they only have one phone down here.
Powder Junction was going to take a little getting used to.
Then I'll call her on the radio.
I plucked the mic from the dash and stopped him as he started to close the door of the unit.
Hey? Call Maynard in about an hour and tell him that we need him to come and talk to us tomorrow morning here at the office.
Santiago smiled.
What time?
Make it early. He continued to smile and adjusted his sunglasses like a movie star, and it wasn't hard to imagine the Gascon with a beret, feather, and sword.
Does this mean I'm being promoted to Chief Undersheriff of the Powder Junction Detachment of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department?
Acting CUSPJD of the ACSD. Sounds impressive, doesn't it? I'll look into getting you a second phone line.
As Sizar Vittoria went into the office, I keyed the mic and sang, "Oh, Ruby, don't take your love to town."
Static. Stop that. Over.
So, you have any news? Static. I've got information on the guy from California. I'm all 10 ears. Static. Tran Van Tuyen became an American citizen in 1982, which is when he obtained an operator's license. He doesn't have so much as a parking ticket to his name.
Well, it was worth a try.
Static. You're not going to start singing again, are you?
I keyed the mic and ignored her. Keep digging. He said he was here looking at some property, the Red Fork Ranch. Get a hold of B.B. and see if she's ever heard of the guy, then call Ned Tannen at the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and see if he can come up with anything.
Static. Roger that.
Anything from DCI?
Static. They just faxed up the report.
There was a pause, and I listened to the silence of the radio.
They got an ID on the young woman.
Who was she?
Static. Her name was Ho Thi Paquette. Turns out she was a Vietnamese illegal who was picked up on prostitution charges in L.A. 6 weeks ago. She was scheduled for deportation, but I haven't gotten any straight answers about what she might have been doing in Wyoming.
Ask Ned to talk to his friends in the Orange County Sheriff's Department and to throw that name around along with Lee Nguyen and Tran Van Tuyen. See if they can come up with something down in Little Saigon. Anything else?
Static. I'll just let you read the report. When are you coming back up?
I'm going to run out and talk to the Dunnigan brothers, and then I'll have Sarge Arbitoria give me a ride back. I figure I can let him have one more night with his wife before banishing him to Powder Junction. How's Dog?
Static. He's fine.
Thanks, Ruby. I paused. Katie and Henry make it back?
Static. Yes, and they're planning on having dinner later.
They say where?
Static. I'm not allowed to say.
Cahoots.
Static. I have a Methodist women's meeting at 7 o'clock, so can you make it by 6:30? I pulled my pocket watch from my jeans and flipped it around.
Easily.
Static. I'm holding you to that.
After talking to Santiago, I commandeered our only vehicle and drove out toward the Rocking D and the ghost town of Bailey. The two kids who had been standing in the fenced-in yard were still there. It took me a minute to find the appropriate switches on the unfamiliar Chevrolet, but I tapped the siren and lights and watched as they jumped up and down, this time in counterpoint, both of them continuing to wave as I made the turn and headed west. Small joys. There had once been a coal mine near the town, but with the caprice of geology and with the disaster that had claimed the lives of 17 miners just after the turn of the century, the last one, Bailey had bailed. All that was left of the settlement were a few buildings clinging to the trailing end of the Bighorn Mountain Range and a cemetery. I slowed to look at the abandoned buildings in the late afternoon sun, vertical structures attempting to join the horizontal landscape. There were only six. A few were wood frame and a few were stone. A couple had storefronts, and only one was worthy of a second story. The old grade walkway was twisted, and the wood was pulled from its substructure, but the rough-cut 2x8s were still there, waiting for the ringing sound of silent boots. There was a union hall and a tipple at the end of the street with an assortment of roofless shacks that had been built along the stone cliffs that rose at the end of the abandoned town. The weedy graveyard was on the far side. 17 markers had been placed where there were no bodies. The disaster had happened when the unfortunate miners had hit a gas pocket, and the resulting explosion had shaken the ground all the way back to Powder Junction, almost 20 miles distant. None of the bodies were recovered, and I always felt strange driving by the lonely little spot of abandoned civilization. There weren't many ghost towns left in the state. Most had been packed away and carted off to amusement parks and tourist destinations along I-80. I guess it would be for the good of the county if we got rid of the fire hazard, but it would be sad to see the place go. One of the buildings had already partially burned when some kids had come up from Casper, had drunk too much beer, chased with too many shots, and had decided to see how quickly 100-year-old buildings would burn. We were lucky in that it was winter and the snow had isolated the damage to one collapsed wall, one DUI, and 3 miners in possession. I doubted many tourists came up 190 to the gravel Bailey Mountain Road
and those that did probably mistook what they saw for the real hole in the wall of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid fame. Through a side canyon, the road leaves the river and the formation of stunning red sandstone with a passage just large enough to allow the entry of a single wagon. A handful of men at this location could hold off an army of sheriffs, but they'd never had to, the Wild Bunch's reputation doing their fighting for them. Fiction writers would have you believe that this spectacular location was the hole in the wall of Western fame. It was in reality a cinematic fabrication at best, and an uninformed lie at worst. The actual hole in the wall was a good 30 miles south and barely noticeable as a slight break in the cliffs, allowing just enough slope for a man on horseback to pass. It had been described by my father to me as the least memorable historic spot in Wyoming. It was now private land on the Willow Creek Ranch, and the Ferg had been pestering me for years about getting him on the place to do a little fishing at the Rustler's settlement, where Buffalo Creek tumbled out of the canyon and into a perfect triangular pasture. The dozen or so log cabins that Butch, Sundance, and the Wild Bunch had used were all gone, the last having been hauled over to Cody in the Buffalo Bill Museum. I continued on my way and drove past the Bailey Public School, which was a one-room schoolhouse, a last bastion of public education with, at last count, 2 students. It troubled me to think about the school closing, the cabins disassembled, and the ghost towns being flattened. It reminded me that the majority of my life had passed. I had started my education in a school very much like the one here, and had spent my childhood in a town a lot like Bailey would have been if there had not been the mining disaster. I thought about Katie as I drove, about Michael, who was due to arrive imminently, about Vic, then about the upcoming election in November and the debate on Friday. I tried to stop thinking and propped my hat over the big eyelid hook that was anchored on the dash. We had a lot of DUIs in Powder Junction, and I guess Double Tough had improvised this way to secure drunken drivers to the vehicle. The road was rough, it obviously hadn't been graded since early spring, and the ruts and bumps kept me from getting the 25-year-old unit above 30. The clouds of dust obscured my view to the rear as I took a right and continued up through the lodgepole pines and scattered cottonwoods that grew along the draws. It was as if life had chosen to run away and hide in the ragged crevices of the harsh country and forgotten to come back out. I trailed along a small ravine where swallows cartwheeled in the thermals of the russet cliffs and glanced over the edge to where the creek still carried the snowmelt of the Bighorn Mountains. It looked like pretty good fishing on the Dunnigan place, but I'd also noted the no-hunting signs and figured that the fish, like everything else, were something the brothers didn't give away. They were both handsome old bachelors. I figured that they hadn't married because they were too tight-fisted to consider a wife. To hear Lucian tell it, their father, Sean Dunnigan, had been like that as well, except that back in the dirty 30s he had had no choice but to marry Eileen if he wanted to eat. He was that broke. Hence, Den and James. Eileen had been known to play her violin from the porch of the ranch house, a lone and plying sound that had echoed from the canyon. She'd never grown used to the isolation of the place, had grown senile on the ranch, and had died in the late 70s, rapidly followed by Sean, who had evidently grown used to the music of the only woman he'd known. The brothers were good hands and tough old boys, tough enough to outlast all their neighbors, and they had slowly bought up the surrounding land and the water and mineral rights until the Dunnigans pretty much owned the Beaver Creek draw. James was the eldest and had inherited the ranch, even though he'd been kicked in the head by a cantankerous mare when he was a teenager and wasn't quite right, as the locals had put it. Den had known that James would inherit, had been pissed off at this rule of succession, but had accepted his lot and consequently taken a job in corrections up in Deer Lodge, Montana. He had even been engaged to a woman, but when the engagement entered its second decade, she took exception. Den had returned at his father's request when it became clear that James couldn't run the ranch by himself, and that Sean had gotten too old to be much of a help.
My professional interaction with the Dunnigans was mostly with Dan. There had been an incident where he had almost killed another rancher with a shovel in an altercation over water rights, and another where he'd broken a bottle off on the bar in town and threatened to perform an amateur tracheotomy on a rodeo cowboy. But other than that, we'd been limited to the instances when Dan would call in a lost James. He did this on a periodic basis. A couple of years earlier, during hunting season and an early snow, we'd responded, along with the highway patrol and the county search and rescue, only to find James seated at the hole-in-the-wall bar, adamant that he had phoned his mother and explained that he was safe and spending the night in town. The problem was that his mother had been dead for a quarter of a century. I rolled across the cattle guard and parked beside a turquoise and white 76 Ford Highboy. The motor was running, but nobody was in it. The ranch house was simple, sided horizontally with a low-slung roof, and there was a metal shop nearby that was four times the size of the house. By the time I got to the sidewalk, Dan was coming out the front door. His eyes widened beyond his usual squint and then settled into a general dissatisfaction at seeing me. He had on a clean white straw hat, hard like plastic, with a black braided horsehair band, and was dressed in a freshly pressed shirt and creased jeans that cut the air as he walked. There was a red and white cotton bandana at his neck, and he'd even polished his boots. I guess I need to turn off my goddamn truck. I stopped at the single step leading into the house. Sorry, Dan, but I need to speak with you and James. He stood there for another moment looking at me, and then hobbled past on bow legs, which approached a full circle, to the parking area where he reached into the side window of the old Ford and shut off the motor. A rifle rack cradling a beaten 30-30 Winchester showed through the rear window. Dan came back down the poured concrete walk, and I could smell the beer on his breath as he scuffled past. I followed him into the house without a word or invitation. The tawny light of early evening was spreading across the Powder River landscape, and it settled a comfortable glow inside the kitchen. James was seated at a Formica table with a shot glass and a bottle of Breyer's Blackberry Brandy, which I assumed was dinner. There was an empty bottle of Busch with more than a few bottle caps pinched together and scattered across the table, where I assumed Den must have been sitting before my arrival. The walls were paneled in knotty pine, and all the appliances were what they had called Golden Harvest in the '50s. I was sure that nothing in the kitchen had been changed since their mother had died. The heat was oppressive, even with the industrial-type box fan that was propped in one of the windows. The older of the two brothers stood when I entered, wiping his palms on his jeans and sticking out his hand. He seemed embarrassed that I'd found him drinking in his own home. "Hello, Walt. Would you like some coffee? Mother makes it in the morning for us." I withheld comment. "No, thanks. Mind if I sit down, James?" He pulled out a chair for me and glanced at his brother, who stood by the door with his arms folded and his hat still on. "I suppose you know why I'm here." James sat back down and laid an arm along the table. "It's about that girl we found?"
"Yep."
He nodded and then trapped his lips between his teeth. "About the bar?"
"Yep.
We did see her there."
I took my hat off and set it on the orange vinyl seat of the chair beside me.
"That's what I understand."
James looked at the surface of the table.
"Well, we don't have to tell you a goddamn thing. We didn't do nothing to that girl."
I turned toward Den, but his eyes were fixed on the linoleum. "I'm not aware of anyone having said you did." He folded his arms a little tighter and continued to look at the floor.
"But that's why you're here, ain't it?"
"There are some questions I wanted to ask you and your brother." I waited a moment.
"Why don't you have a seat, and we'll talk?"
He sat on a fold-out stool by the refrigerator. I turned back to James.
"You want to tell me about the bar?"
It took him a while to speak, and he didn't answer my question, but instead gestured toward the bottle on the table.
"Would you like a little, Walt? I'll get you a clean glass."
"No, thank you." I waited and started getting the feeling that there might be something more to this than I had at first anticipated. James licked his lips and poured himself another shot of the sugary liquor.
It was hot on Friday, so we took a little break about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. You know, duck in for a cool one.
I noticed his hands were shaking as he put the bottle back down.
She was in there, sitting at the end of the bar, so Den and I sat a couple of stools away.
He looked up and smiled sadly.
She was a good-looking young woman, and she kept glancing over at us.
His eyes turned to the full shot glass.
We're just a couple of old hands, Walt. We're not used to a good-looking young woman paying us much attention.
You talked to her? Den interrupted.
Hell, we thought she was a Jap. She didn't speak no English.
I waited, and James started again.
We tried to buy her a couple of drinks, but she wouldn't take them. After a while, she got up and waved a little wave at us and left.
Bartender can tell you that.
I looked at Den. Then what? He clammed up, sullen again, but James cleared his throat, and I turned back to watch him down his shot. It seemed to me his face was redder than it ought to have been.
We went out and started to get in the truck, and she was standing by her car like she was waiting for us.
Den interrupted again.
She was damn well waiting for us.
I tried to keep the conversation moving. Then what? James cleared his throat again and looked as if all the blood in his body was rising in his face.
She needed gas money. His face continued to grow redder. And if I hadn't known any better, I'd have said that both of the Dunnigan brothers were about to implode of embarrassment. And she wanted to couple with us.
I sat there for a moment to make sure I'd heard what I heard.
I thought you said she didn't speak any English.
James seemed to be on the edge of a cardiac arrest.
She didn't, but...
Then how could you tell that? Den yanked off his straw hat and threw it against the kitchen cabinets.
She grabbed James's crank and pointed toward the gas cap. That good enough for you? God damn it!
I stopped at the top of the office stairs and stood there glancing around the reception area and listened to the continuing ring of the phone. It was late, but the lights were all on and Ruby's purse sat in her chair along with her sweater. I stumbled forward and ran to get the phone, but as I reached for it, it stopped. I stared at the red light that had stopped blinking but stayed steady. Someone had gotten it, someone in the building. Dog was gone, too. I walked down the hallway and past my darkened office where I looked for any post-its on the door jamb. Post-its were our prose form of communication, but there was only one, and it was from Katie. I held the yellow square up to the light and read, "Daddy, we're at the Winchester. Come join us." Ruby had marked the time at 6:17 p.m. 4 hours ago. There was a noise from the back of the building, so I continued to the end of the hall, where I could see the lights on in the holding cells and the kitchenette. I stopped in the doorway and watched as Ruby stepped away from the phone on the adjacent wall and sat down in one of our metal folding chairs to pet dog and resume what looked like knitting. I leaned against the wall and spoke.
"Ruby?"
She didn't hear me, even though dog looked up and wagged. "Ruby!" She glanced up and looked stern.
"I missed my Methodist women's meeting."
Her eyes shifted to the holding cell, and I leaned around the corner for a peek at our only inmate. He was eating with his fingers, and there was a carefully stacked pile of pot pie containers near the door of the cell. He didn't look up when I stepped around the wall to get a better look at him. His hair hung down around his face and to his knees, but he had on the sweatpants I'd provided and the moccasins.
I guess he woke up.
And he was hungry.
I glanced at the assembled cartons at the big Indian's feet.
How many has he eaten?